The first thing we're going to do is go on a little active imagination journey back in time. So the way to do this is I want to invite you in a moment to close your eyes. I'm not going to do anything weird, all right? I'm not going to come up and sneak up behind you or anything like that. I'm going to invite you to close your eyes, and I'm going to set the stage, and we're very simply going to go back in time. And what we're interested in doing is allowing our own imagination to have a say in what we see. And the journey, I'll just tell you right from the beginning, we're going to go back and look at our own human origin story. How do we get here? How did any of us get here? What are the tributaries and streams that brought forth who we are and the Homo sapien, as we're As we've immodestly called ourselves. Sapien means wise, by the way. So that's where we're headed. And I want to encourage you, if you've ever done any kind of guided meditation or active imagination, to not try very hard. All right? You don't have to make anything happen. You might wonder partway something like, what the hell are we doing right now? And you just allow that to be. Or you might have some surprising things come into your imagination, and I suggest go with those. Not, well, I hope I do this the right way. There is no right way. We're just journeying back, and we're going to allow ourselves to engage in our own origin story, first through imagination. And then I'll tell you where we're going after that. So go ahead, get comfortable, and close your eyes. And just take a couple of deep breaths, just breathing in the air and breathing out, and breathing in the air of this place. Here we are in West Michigan, in this little corner of the universe, of the cosmos, breathing in the cold 13-degree air and breathing out the same air that we share with crows and squirrels and grasses and pine trees, and just breathing in and out, just relaxing. And for this particular journey, I want to invite you to get on a little canoe in your imagination. Here you are in a little canoe, and we're going to enter the water here, the stream, the river, and go back upstream. It's not difficult to row, it's quite easy, dipping your paddle in the water and rowing upstream. And we're going back in time. And maybe around the first bend in our time travel journey, you're seeing your own relatives, those who have come before you. Your own ancestors, the ones that you know about, the ones that you've heard stories about. There they are. You see them on the side of the river doing life. Who are these people? Where did they come from? And maybe you even hear a different language or a different dialect or different words being used. And you continue to row upstream, dipping your paddle in the water again and going further back in time. Maybe back to the ancestors that you don't know the names of, but maybe to the time of your own sort of family or tribal traditions, your heritage. And maybe you don't know anyone by name here. Maybe your name hasn't even been spoken, your family name, but these are your ancestors. Maybe you notice they're in a certain part of the world. Maybe you notice some things about that part of the world. And maybe you can even see, if you take the time, what these people are doing, what kinds of tools they have, and maybe what their homes look like and their clothes, what do they look like? And you pause here for a moment, maybe even with a little nod of gratitude, like, hey, thanks for making it. And you continue upstream and you're paddling upstream and you're going deeper into antiquity now. And maybe you've reached the dawn of the agricultural age here, and you're looking around and you're seeing the first organized agricultural efforts by our great, 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 great grandparents. What does that look like? Just allowing the images to come. What are they doing? What are these people doing? Where are they in the world? What's the climate like? What kind of clothes are they wearing? Maybe you're hearing languages you've never heard before. Maybe they have, maybe they're carrying tools that you recognize, but maybe you've never used. These are our agrarian ancestors, and after a few moments, you dip your paddle in the water again, and you're heading upstream, and now you're going even deeper into antiquity to the hunter-gatherers who make up a vast stretch of time. And maybe you're noticing that the groups on the side of the river are now a little smaller. Maybe they're extended family units. What are they up to? What are they up to? What do they look like there on the side of the river? What sort of tools might they have, or dialects, or clothing? And what does the forest look like here? What kinds of things are they gathering? What do you notice? And it turns out you have to paddle for some time because you keep encountering more and more of these bands of people, what we now call hunter-gatherers, deeper and deeper into antiquity. And here you round the bend, and this is as far back into antiquity as you have ever gone. This is the furthest upstream you have ever rowed. And you come around the bend and you start to notice people, Homo erectus, upright people, but they look a little different. What do you see? Just allowing your imagination to run free here. And what do you see? And what kinds of things are these very ancient ancestors up to? What do they have in common? How are they different than who we are, than who you are? And maybe you take one more paddle stroke up here, going as far back into antiquity as you have ever gone. The very first recognizable, what we would think of as humans of some sort. This is as far back as you've ever gone. And what do they look like? Who are they? What are their cares and concerns? Maybe here you even nod. Maybe your nodding is not even understood, or you wave, and your waving is not understood. Or maybe it is. And these great, 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 triple, quadruple, great grandparents and ancestors. And here you say a little prayer of gratitude, and you turn around in your canoe, and you're now flowing with the river, and you're passing back through these phases of our own human story back toward Grand Haven here, parking your canoe on the Grand River and getting out and coming into the community center and warming up a bit and opening your eyes. Okay. Who knew C3 could be so fun? How many of you were surprised that certain images were coming up? Anyone? Any kind of surprises? I'm not going to ask you to share what they are, but and I'm going to just ask you to hold on to this sort of exercise as we talk about some facts around our human origin story and why talk about it. First of all, I'll get to that in a second. Because having an imagination, I could even say, is deeply part of what it means to be a human being. It's important to imagine, how did we get here? How did we get here? How did any of you get here? How did I get here? How did we get here? What kinds of concerns and values and interests and wars and famines and trials and errors and deaths and births? How many of those events had to take place for us to be here? I think it's important to reflect on these things. Part of being a human being is to imagine, how do we get here? What are the tributaries and streams into the flow that we call our lives here in the 21st century? And in addition to having an imagination for the past, part of being a human being is having an imagination for the future. And here I'd like to just make a claim. We need fresh imagination for the future. You've heard me use the poem here, "The only war is the war against imagination." The only war is the war against imagination. We need an imagination for the future that is both informed by the past and also sort of creatively free to imagine, if we were to keep going on this river, what might be around the future bend. And none of you know for sure, unless some of you are like, have a crystal ball that I don't know about. But having an imagination for the future is also partly how any of us got here. Our ancestors had an imagination for how to live. And they said, if I'm going to make it through the winter, I'm going to have to do certain things. See, feel how that's a journey of imagination as much as anything else? I have to imagine, what will it be like in 1 month from now when I can no longer harvest crops, or, you know, the geese have migrated south. Maybe I should follow them. We might wonder to ourselves in our imagination. So I'm just highlighting the value of imagination. And here is a question I just want us to kind of dance around. And it has to do with the incredible time period that we find ourselves in, which is, I think, in some senses, scary, unprecedented, and also packed with potential and potential of imagination. And it has to do with how any of us got here. So human beings have, in all cultures that we know of, have had their own origin stories. Some of those are called creation stories. I prefer the phrase origin stories because creation sounds a little technical, like how things, you know, got molded or created. I mean, that's an important question, but just origin, I like, is broader. All human cultures have shared the reality of having origin stories, even if those origin stories are a little bit different. And those origin stories tell us something important about how to live. They're not just like what we would call facts. They're trying to read the world in a certain way to ask questions, how should we live? How do we get here? How should we live? And where are we going? So origin stories matter. And what I mean about the unbelievable age that we live in right now is that most of those traditional and historic origin stories are cracking in some way. They're not really working all that well. Do you know what I'm talking about? The stories that we've told ourselves about how we have got here are not working all that well. And brand new things have come onto the scene, something that our great-great-great-grandparents didn't imagine, as far as we know. And we might call that evolution. Brand new on the scene of human cultures and how we begin to contemplate, what is the meaning of life? How did we get here? Where are we going? What are we up to? What are our values? So the fact that evolution is giving us trouble shouldn't really surprise us. It's brand new on the scene. And people, maybe you've learned this from from the last couple years, just because there's new information doesn't mean people are going to accept it. Are you with me? That's coming with like a wink, all right? We all have a hard time with that because we like the story that we're living in, even if it's not working all that well. Have I made sense? Now, let me just present a cultural problem. One of our cultural problems that we're wrestling with this month is around the question of diversity. One of the things that we value at C3 is diversity in several respects. And not only do we value it, we want to promote it. And we can mean all kinds of things by that. We mean racial diversity, we celebrate racial diversity, we celebrate diversity of sexual orientation. We celebrate diversity of thought. That's something I mentioned last week. I know, because some of you come to the pre-talk thing, you don't all think the same way. All right? Imagine that. And these are things that we celebrate. And one of the things that's happening is to us is as the world becomes more diverse, it also puts pressure on our origin stories. Like questions like, well, how important am I? How important is my family? How important is my race or my ethnicity or my religion or my identity? How important is that compared to my neighbors and brothers and sisters and their particular place? So one of the things I just want to wrestle with is I want to give you a little window. And some of you will know these things anyway, but I want to give you a little window into our story as Homo sapiens. And in the back of your mind, start asking a question like this. How diverse are we as a human species? How diverse are we? Is this something that we can celebrate? The amazing story of our arrival. Okay, so first, I'll start with just some very basic facts. Something like, to the best of our ability to know, Homo erectus arrived on the scene about 2.5 million years ago. All right, 2.5 million years ago. Seems like a long time. And we don't know very much about these early beings other than they stood upright, hence the name, Homo erectus, stood upright. And what seems to be the most relevant and pressing information right now is that there was not just one Homo erectus that one time stood up and started the progress that we that brings us to Grand Haven in the 21st century. But it actually seems to be the case that there were many different kinds of Homo erectus, different species with different names and different body types. Some of them you've heard of, like the Neanderthals. You remember those stupid commercials a few years ago? It was like, it's so easy, a caveman can do it. The Geico, okay. What's interesting about those commercials is that it's rooted in a certain conception of evolution that has largely been disputed, and at least holes have been poked into, which is something like, our Neanderthal ancestors were stupid. Okay, and that's what the commercial is kind of playing on. So easy, a caveman could do it. But actually, Neanderthals had larger brains and much bigger biceps. Now, we don't know, just because you have a bigger brain doesn't necessarily, mean you might have advances in the cognitive department, but it is an interesting fact. And you had, I always forget the name of Denisovan, I think that's the name of it. Another whole group of people that were roughly about 3 feet tall, okay, who lived on this earth doing things like making tools and hunting and gathering for tens of thousands of years. Same with the Neanderthals. At one time, if we were paddling back in time, say about 150,000 years ago when Homo sapiens, the wise ones, came up out of East Africa, is the most likely theory, they started bumping into all these other kinds of Homo erectus, including small ones, including giant Neanderthals, including about 8 or 9 other versions. Now, that is weird. Am I right? Isn't that a little weird? I mean, we look around and think we're at the top of our game here and there's nobody like us. For tens of thousands of years, Homo sapiens lived alongside other kinds of humans. That is very weird. And we think, oh, we know what life is about. We know where we came from. We know the story, but we really don't know the story. And by the way, there are two sort of opposing views about human evolution. I'll just give them to you in short. One is the theory, the replacement theory, that up came Homo sapiens because they were so smart, there was something that amounts to a kind of ethnic cleansing and wiped out all these other groups. And there's some possible truth here, okay? The other, which has now been proven in 2010, which makes things more complicated, is what we would call interbreeding, okay? It's actually much more sort of like, I don't know what you would call it, Western and American to think, up came the sapiens out of Africa and they conquered the world. But turns out, up came the sapiens out of Africa and they slept with some people. That's what happened. So when we start to wonder about our origin story, it gets very complex very quickly. And in certain parts of the world, certain people, Homo sapiens, have as much as 6% Denisovan DNA. Most of you in this room have between 1 and 4% Neanderthal DNA. Your great-grandparents were promiscuous, but we're taking it to the next level here, promiscuity. All right. Now, I don't know if they had a moral code, so I'm applying a sort of moral map here. But why am I saying that? It's because just because some of our origin stories are cracking, like very simple views of the creation story, like 5,000 years ago, God got really bored and was like, and we have human beings. You know, what about dinosaur bones? Don't worry. God created the earth with age. Why? That's, by the way, the one of the possibilities. I don't know, to mess with us, to trick us. Like, these are dinosaur bones. He's like, haha, I got you, you know. There weren't really dinosaurs. Or I don't know, okay. There's nothing wrong with the fact that our narratives crack. That's just what happens over time. But when I start to contemplate what I would call a need for revisiting our own origin stories, it really cries out, our own evolutionary story cries out tremendous diversity. That's what seems to be screaming at us. Tremendous diversity. Including all the way down to the DNA level. You know, your brothers and sisters, so to speak, are kind of wildly diverse. And one of the things that's kind of silly to say is diversity helpful in the evolutionary process? Well, yes. How do we know that? Because we're here, you know? We're here, and instead of not being here, which is certainly a possibility when it comes to these things. Okay, so let me just look at my notes and figure out what I've said that I planned on saying and what I would like to try to go toward now. Okay. So here are some wonderings of mine. And some of this comes from Brian Swim and Thomas Berry. They have a book on the universe story. I think that's the name of the book, The Universe Story. One of the things they argue with is that we need an ongoing conversation around our own evolutionary story as a sort of sacred myth, as a kind of, I wouldn't say replacement, but in conversation with the other forms of creation stories or origin stories. We don't have to dismiss them all outright and say, well, there's nothing in Genesis because it's not a scientific book. Well, that probably wasn't its aim. There were no scientists, there were no historians, there were no biologists, there were no evolutionary experts or people sequencing DNA. They weren't interested in those kinds of questions. So we don't have to completely dismiss them. But maybe alongside of the narratives that have helped shape us, we need something like evolution as a sacred story, as a sacred myth. Which leads me to a couple questions. If I were to ask you what Darwin is most famous for, what would you say? Don't say evolution, that's too easy. What do people associate with Darwin? And okay, thank you. Survival of the fittest. Which is something that he says, but he doesn't exactly say it in quite the same way. And one of the things that has I think, unfairly influenced the question around our origin story is to think that everything in the world was dog-eat-dog, nature's red in tooth and claw, and only the survival of the fittest, meaning those who are only the most powerful and aggressive and dominant and strong are the ones that survive. That's why we have things like the Super Bowl, all right? That's survival of the fittest. But we apply that, and not that there's zero truth to that, but we apply that across the board. That's how we got here. But Darwin was much more clever than that. And what he seems to be suggesting, I'm just going to rephrase, is something like the survival of those who are most able to adapt, those who are most able to cooperate. If you really get into anthropology, one of the things that the anthropologists are suggesting is why did Homo sapiens end up faring better in the long run than, say, the Neanderthals? It's because they learned to cooperate with one another better. That's very interesting. You mean they weren't stronger and more powerful? No, we know that as a fact. The Neanderthals were stronger and more powerful and had bigger brains, but for some reason they couldn't figure out how to cooperate. That's the suggestion. It's still, it's a theory, but it seems to have some legitimacy. That should tell you something, that one of the most important things that brought any of us here in terms of our origin story was learning how to cooperate and cooperate with other human beings in all their wild diversity. Isn't that interesting? Now, if that is true, might that not inform what are we supposed to do right now? As we paddle downstream toward the future, what kinds of things matter? Well, the kinds of things that we've learned up to this point, which is if we can learn to cooperate with one another in our environment, we fare much better. And now we have something called science that backs that up, and not just instinct and myth and story, which are things that preceded the scientific era, the scientific age. So, hovering around the question of how did any of us get here, I think, is much more of an urgent and serious sort of enterprise than maybe it at first sounds. So let me say it this way. Our understanding of how we got here shapes our imagination for what's going on now and our imagination for the future. Okay, I'm going to list some questions just so I can support Beth's quest for making note of all my many questions. Here are questions that come to mind. What challenges are inherent in our species? What challenges are inherent? If it's true that at one point in human history, we thought ethnic cleansing was a good idea, let's not be naive that this is a major challenge, because guess what? You're not all that different than 150,000 years ago. Did you know, by the way, if someone were to die 150,000 years ago and they were to put that body in the morgue today and have it inspected, the person in the morgue would not know that this person was from, there's nothing structurally different about this person that would indicate that they're 150,000 years old. Have I made sense what I'm saying? Okay, so what challenges are inherent in our species, which requires us to look at our story? How do we get here? What opportunities are inherent in our human species? What do we know that has helped us up to this point? So I'm asking, what has hurt us and what has helped us? Here's a question that has to do with race. How are we going to talk about what makes us the same and what makes us different? That's a pretty challenging, I think, brand new thing that we have to wrestle with. How are we the same and how are we different? It's not that easy to parse out and requires a certain amount of celebration of our differences with also the desire to know what binds us in a kind of paradox. Here's a question that no one really wants to think much about. Is evolution fair? All right? I know there's a lot of concern about fairness. Is evolution fair? What's the answer to that? Well, it might be like, the answer might be, should we be applying moral categories to evolution? But that's part of the question I think we have to wrestle with. Okay, if evolution isn't fair, how do we want to be? You could easily claim evolution is not fair. We're simply evolving animals. There's no need to be fair. Do you know how easy you can get to that conclusion? So why be even concerned about things like justice in light of our unfolding story? Okay, I'm going to finish. I'm going to say that we form beliefs about the world, whether we know it or not. And those beliefs, part of those beliefs are rooted in how we think we got here. And examination of those beliefs, I think, matters a great deal. It's possible those who could not adjust their beliefs are the ones that are lost to history. It's possible that those who could not adjust their beliefs to what's really going on are the ones who are lost to history. That's worth, I think, thinking about. Now, close your eyes and then we'll be done. So, close your eyes just for a second and now paddle forward. Now you're going downstream. And maybe on the right and the left are possible worlds. Possible worlds. Humanity could go this way or that way. What are these possible worlds? And one of the things that is non-negotiable when it comes to evolution as a kind of origin story, how you live today affects these possible worlds. What's on the right? What's on the left of the bank? A world that's sick, a world that's healthy. And we'll end right there.